Ugh, another pointless video call where nothing gets done. I think you're on mute, David.
Sorry. What did I miss?
IT just approved Miro for the whole company.
Miro? That's the...
online whiteboard. For team collaboration. We can make these long video meetings so much shorter with Miro boards. We can share ideas, feedback, and updates on them whenever. Actually see what we're talking about.
It's all online.
Miro will make our flexible work setup so much easier. With one virtual space for our brainstorms, projects, presentations.
Oh, that sounds kind of amazing. So I don't need to wake up for 6 a.m. calls with the London office anymore.
Now you're getting it.
Don't let time zones get in the way of your team working well together. See why 99% of the Fortune 100 trust Miro to get good work done from anywhere. Get your first three boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hi guys, Pete and Rich here. The Boys in the Band podcast is back. But before we get into the main show, we've just got to tell you about a cool deal from our sponsors, Beer 52.
Yep, they've come up with a great deal for listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. So if you fancy a free case of 8 craft beers from Beer 52, just go to beer52.com/band. And all you have to do is cover the postage cost of $5.95.
And as well as that free case, you also get signed up to Beer 52's beer club, the largest in the world with over 150,000 active members. And each month, members are sent a case with a different theme, as well as a magazine and a snack. You can, of course, pause or cancel at any time, but it's well worth trying out.
So head over to beer52.com/band for that offer, and we hope you enjoy the upcoming pod. Hello and welcome to the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith. And on this week's show, we're joined by Adam Nutter, the lead guitarist from The Music. Really interesting guy. He was open and honest about lots of different aspects of being in the band. And we covered a wide range of topics, didn't we, Rich? From their sound and their releases to iconic artwork, which even now, I think, when you see it, just think The Music, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, absolutely love the artwork. And of course, that band name, you know, it's something that we chatted about before. So how Google-friendly is your band name? And in this case, for The Music, not so much. You know, they released their debut album back in 2002, and I wonder if they were launching now whether they might go for something a little bit more search engine friendly.
Yeah, me and Rich have often discussed this over a few beers, haven't we, Rich? How Google friendly is your band name? Brand New was one that always stuck out for me. It was like, try and Google Brand New Music to actually find music by Brand New. It's not easy.
No, very tricky indeed. There are a few like that, when they're Good Books and Good Shoes or ones we mentioned before, and Special Needs band we've had on, and Dogs was the other one. I used to like the band Dogs, but you know, you Google Dogs, it's a far cry to find the music that you're actually looking for. But tricky concept picking that band name. But here's Adam talking about how the band name came about and how it affected them.
And on reflection, I'm sure the name caused great confusion, not only when trying to search, but almost like when trying to have a conversation with someone who's not really paying attention, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh, this is The Music. And they're like, oh, come on, I'm not stupid. What are you on about? Do you know what I mean? So I'm sure it has. But it, for me, for what it sort of was and, you know, what the legacy we left, I love the name, really. It's sort of, I say it was almost like a mission statement, in a sense that, you know, that's all we really cared about. But, you know, I'm not being funny. We couldn't really be bothered coming up with a name. Do you know what I mean? For ages, for this 2-year period, we didn't have a name. And Tim were just like, we've got to come up with a name. And we were just not bothered. And one day Tim went, what about the music? What? No, Tim said, what about music? And I went, what about The Music? And then it were a bit like, all right, that's that decision made. Brilliant, move on. You know what I mean? It's not like we were sat there going, right, we've got this music, we've got this band, you know what I mean? We need to find a name that's really going to catch people's. We just didn't give a damn about anything like that.
Yeah, you can get yourself into all sorts of twists talking about the music of The Music and what The Music thought about their music, but we gave it a good go. And we also chatted with Adam about some of the music, there it is again, that he's working on now after, he put down the guitar for 10 years and he's just recently picked up again and is working on some new music. So That's, yeah, have a listen out for that. It's an interesting story there.
Yeah, incredible. You can sort of be in a band all that time and then just have a complete cut off from a guitar for so long. But he also touches on sort of the mental health side of things, the toll that everyone in the music felt during their rapid rise and pretty wild rides. So loads to get stuck into with this band, a band I absolutely loved back in the day. Even now, when I hear the first chords of some of those big tunes of theirs, I just have to whack the volume right up. And I wholeheartedly recommend you do the same after the pod. So here we go. Give it a listen. And as always, let us know what you think about it on social media. But here's Adam Nutter from The Music.
Just one thing to flag, obviously the podcast was recorded a couple of months ago, and since then, unfortunately, the Music Reunion show has had to be pushed back till June 2022. So during the pod, we chat about it being in May 2021. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out like that, but hopefully we will see the boys back on stage next year.
This week on the Boys in a Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by The Music's Adam Nutter. Thanks for joining us, Adam. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. No problem at all. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're all good. Thanks, mate. Yeah, thanks for coming on. So, Adam, we kick off our podcast with the sound check. And the first question we always ask is, whereabouts are you today?
I'm in Leeds, East Leeds, a little place called Kippax.
Kippax, that's where it started, wasn't it, the band?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, still there, yeah.
Good.
Nice. Good stuff. And what are you listening to at the moment, Adam?
A lot of my own stuff, to be honest. I mean, that's all I'm doing at the moment. I'm just writing. So, yeah, a lot of my own stuff, really. I mean, it's been a while since I've sort of sat down and listened to like a full record or anything like that. I mean, I'm always flying, you know, I've always got YouTube open just putting stuff on, but it has been a long time since I sit down and listened to anything. But as I say, listening to a lot of my own stuff at the moment because I'm sort of absorbed in that, you know, sort of developing stuff and new ideas, old ideas. So, yeah, that's kind of what I'm listening to.
Cool. All immersed in the new music. I like that. We'll get onto that a bit later in the show. Now, this is a question we started asking when we kicked off the series in April, Adam. It's a bit more tricky now. It's what's the best recent gig you've been to?
That's always a difficult one for me, is that? Because, well, I mean, I don't really go to gigs, do you know what I mean? I never have, to be honest, other than ones that we were at, if you know what I mean.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, it's not something that I've really been that into, sort of going out, watching bands. As I say, you know, this started when we were 16, so I was just kind of straight into it. So, I don't know, like, the last thing I'd want to do, having been touring and stuff like that, is go out and watch other bands, to be honest. But that's just me. But, I don't know if I could even say it, best gig. I mean, touring with Queens at Stone Age in Australia, watching them every day were absolutely amazing. Yeah, that were good.
Yeah, that's a great experience. Well, you might not like going to gigs, but you're hosting one, aren't you? The Music are doing a comeback show in May next year, Temple Newsom. Yeah, this sounds really good, Adam. Tell us a bit about this, about how it all came together.
Well, I mean, it was a relatively organic process, really, much like sort of how it all started. This has been a similar sort of thing in that we did the listening party, didn't we? I think during lockdown, obviously, Tim Burgess started his listening parties and he wanted to do one for us. So that resulted in a little bit of contact between us, what we're talking about and stuff. And we all started Twitters to get involved. I think, you know, some were already on Twitter. The listening party was such a great experience. It was more the reaction to it, to be honest. It was more and even when the listening party was announced and there was a lot of reaction on Twitter, it was just clear that there was a lot of affection for us. And that basically led to an offer of a gig in Leeds, you know, which we thought about for a long time, and then we decided it, you know, it was something that we would like to do. So, I mean, that's kind of how it came about.
Yeah, cool. Sounds really good. Really looking forward to that, Adam. But let's jump back to the start then. So you said that the gigs came about organically, and the same sort of happened when you started out as a band. So tell us how a group of schoolmates formed a band and went on to be called the best unsigned band in the country by the NME and Stephen Mack.
Yeah, well, right time, right place. I don't know, really. But like you say, we went to school together. You know, so me, Rob and Stu did. And we were very much in the music block all the time. rather than sort of out playing football with being music block. I mean, it's not really a lot to it, other, you know, in the sense that we came together naturally when we were about late 15, 16. We all started learning his instruments. Rob was in like another band, like doing covers and stuff like that. I really liked his voice. I just started playing guitar and, you know, coming up with my own songs and melodies and stuff like that and other bits. So I saw Rob a couple of times, loved his voice, and basically made it my mission to, you know, get him to be the singer in the band, really, to start a band with him. So I was already playing, jamming with Stu in the music block on lunchtime and stuff. So Stu was, you know, straight away on bass. And then the band that Rob was in, Phil was the drummer in. So Rob brought Phil with him. So, you know, we kind of, obviously Phil went to a different school, but that's kind of how we all came together. And, you know, we just used to practice above a pub after school and stuff. And then there was a church hall as well in Kippax that we practiced in. Was it twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays? Can't remember now. It wasn't long before we entered, just for a laugh, we entered Bright Young Things, which was like a, you know, like a talent show. And at that talent show was Tim Viggan, who at the time was working for Coalition PR, who were doing PR for, you know, biggest bands in the country, The Verve and stuff like that, all kinds of stuff. Esau was there, and basically that resulted in him then starting up Coalition Management off the back of effectively discovering us. He set up like a management company, became our manager. And, you know, that's how that snowball started rolling, really. And then from then on, really, it was progressively, it was gradually progressive in terms of how we were drip fed into the, you know, the music industry, in inverted commas. You know, it's not like we just went straight away in there. We had a long development period. Well, because you have to, you know, we were only 16. We had a long development period of about 2 years, after which we started touring. You know what I mean? Finished as educations and stuff, and went out on the road pretty much.
And in terms of, you know, take the long road and walk it was the demo, wasn't it, that got a lot of traction for you guys?
Yeah.
So how did you sort of end up leaning towards that sort of sound? What were the inspirations that you guys were listening to at that time?
Incredibly different for all of us. You know, it's not like we were collectively listening to anything. We've all got very different tastes in music, and that sort of resulted in us all bringing them together. You know, I've only ever been in one band, so we didn't sit down and decide who we wanted to sound like or anything. We didn't sit down and go, oh, they're cool, we're going to sound like them. Nothing like that. I mean, if anything, we were all trying to just bring our own thing into it. Do you know what I mean? Stu sort of brought a heavy element, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, and Phil brought like a dance element, Chemical Brothers and stuff like that, Prodigy. And, you know, Rob brought sort of what he does as sort of Jim Morrison vibes. And, you know, I brought what I were doing. So, you know, it was just a melting pot of different inspirations, really, that resulted in just this. It was, you know, because it was like a mishmash, really, what we were doing, you know. But it was like I don't know whether you'd call it a happy accident. It has to be a happy accident because it wasn't planned. You know, we didn't go, right, we're gonna sort of start this type of music and be this sort of band. You know, it didn't work like that at all. It's literally what came out. We very rarely talked about how we wanted something to sound.
And who do you think you sounded most like? I know, like, whenever a new band comes along, there's always comparisons, and I think there were some really wide ranging ones when the music started out. Which ones were way far off the mark in your opinions, and which ones were most accurate, do you reckon?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. Sort of stepping outside, I can understand the majority of them. Do you know what I mean? From different avenues, like Led Zeppelin, I can understand that. Yeah, you know. Well, I mean, you know, that will have influenced, especially Stu and Phil as well, but not so much me. You know, not out of choice. I just wasn't listening to that sort of music until we really started touring, and, you know, Stu had it on the stereo a lot. Everyone's got different ones, aren't they? I mean, it will also depend on which album you're talking about, I suppose, because all three of our albums, they all come from different places, I think. Again, not necessarily intentionally, it's just what we were doing at the time. So I don't know. I think Led Zepp's one of the most common ones, but I don't think that's necessarily like a musical comparison as much as for really good musicians sort of coming out with like a sound that's not just like everything else, I suppose. I mean, I don't know. It's so subjective in it, comparisons, but we've never fitted into a genre really. And I don't know. I've never thought we sounded like anyone really, especially sort of the way I play guitar and the way Rob sings. And then it put on top of that, you know, what Phil does and what Stu brings. I don't think there's many bands that really sound like us, to be honest. I don't know.
Yeah, I think especially if you're from inside the band, and as you say, you've got all these different influences within the band and the way it comes together. But it's what critics do, doesn't it? Music critics, they all need to say, oh, they sound a bit like this. So just so readers, I guess, have an idea of what to expect when they hit
play. Totally, man. I mean, it's not something that's ever bothered me. It's more, I don't know, it's more like you say, music is different for everyone, and it will remind people of different bands. And you know what I mean? I could say, oh, that sounds like that. And someone else could be like, well, I don't get that at all. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, well, I can't believe that you don't get that. So, it really is so different for everyone, I think.
Yeah. So let's talk about debut album then. Charts at number 4. Like, it's just incredible. So we talked about this organic process. Your first band you're in, you set it up with your mates, this, and it just gathers pace. And this must just be mind-blowing that your album's charting this high, and it's just, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, mind-blowing is definitely the word. But again, you have to understand that because it all happened over like 2 years and the management was so clever in like, I couldn't really say how many times a month things would happen, but things would happen regularly and they got progressively more exciting and more exciting until it just kind of felt normal for things like that, really. The chart position wasn't really something we focused on too much. Don't get me wrong, you know, it's brilliant, but it was more, I mean, to answer your question really, how did that feel? It's a lot easier to reflect on it now, because at the time, as I say, I mean, you know, there's probably elements of taking it for granted, to be honest, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, there's some bands that we've spoken to, some musicians who've said, you know, if you don't know anything else, if your first album does really well, you just assume that's what happens. You're in a band, you get signed, and your first album goes well.
Exactly. And that was true. You know, our manager was on my podcast the other week, and he was saying the same thing, you know, because we were his first real band, you know, his first experiences were doing PR for the Verve around Urban Hymns and the Charlatans and stuff like that. So he'd been around albums blowing up. So when he started management, and, you know, that's one thing he wanted to do. He wanted everything to be an event, build things up naturally, you know, don't ramp, you know, sort of do it the right way, really. And, you know, as a result of which, like you say, you're just like, well, this is how it must happen for everyone. But, you know, on reflection, obviously, that's not the case. And we were very, you know, I don't know whether you say we're lucky or right place, right time. A lot of different things, I suppose, would come into play. But it was certainly, absolutely, it was brilliant. Do you know what I mean? You felt on top of the world, certainly. But, you know, just to be a part of something like that, to create something and then, you know, be the core of this family, this team of people who are all working really hard to, you know, make everything work. It's brilliant.
Yeah, obviously didn't do you any harm with the success you had, but I did always wonder about the band name, Adam. Did it, in sort of the world of Google, did you run into any problems with that? Are people trying to find you when you're starting out?
Well, I suppose it's difficult to say, really, isn't it? Because I want thought searching for us, but... you know, maybe it did, but we were like that. And especially, our first EP had a swear word in title track. Yeah, yeah. You know, we always did stuff that, not, and again, it wasn't deliberate. It's just how it sort of worked out. But we always did stuff that held us back in certain ways. And on reflection, yeah, I'm sure the name caused great confusion, not only when trying to search, but almost like when trying to have a conversation with someone who's not really paying attention, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh, this is the music, and they're like, oh, I'm not stupid. What are you on about? Do you know what I mean? So I'm sure it has, but it, for me, for what it sort of was, and, you know, what the legacy we left, I love the name, really. It's sort of, it was almost like a mission statement in a sense that, you know, that's all we really cared about. But you know, I'm not being funny. We couldn't really be bothered coming up with a name. Do you know what I mean? For ages, for this 2-year period, we didn't have a name. And Tim were just like, we've got to come up with a name. We've got to come up with a name. And we just weren't bothered. And one day Tim went, what about the music? Well, no, Tim said, what about music? And I went, what about the music? And then it were a bit like, yeah, all right, that's that decision made. Brilliant, move on. You know what I mean? It's not like we were sat there going, right, we've got this music, we've got this band, you know what I mean? We need to find a name that's really going to catch people's. We just didn't give a damn about anything like that. We're just like, whatever. If you want a name, push us into coming up with a name then, because we won't come up with it by ourselves. You know, you'll have to poke and prod us until we go, all right, you know, say something and we'll say yes or no.
Well, what about the artwork for that album? Because that's iconic. That colourful circle and the font for the music, the name of the band written above it. That was, you know, that really stands in my memory as, you know, a real standout symbol of the band. How did that come about?
Well, that's interesting as well. That was our other manager, another part of Coalition Management, Tony Perrin. He was at an art show, I believe. I think he was just out recreationally, as you do at an art show. And he saw Rob and Nick Carter at this exhibition. I'm pretty sure I'm right. But anyway, he saw it and thought, right, that'd be perfect for the music. So spoke to Rob and Nick Carter on the night. And at the time, they were new artists. You know, they're absolutely massive now, very successful. At the time, they were new artists. So they turned around and said, yeah, you can have the rights to use it, but you have to buy one now. So Tony had to shell out £1,000 for one of the full-size circles. And at the time, he was petrified. He told us recently, actually, he said, they said, if you want the rights, you've got to buy it now. So I bought it and I thought, oh, my wife's going to kill me. Oh, God, you know what I mean? But, you know, in retrospect, the one he bought, God knows how much that'll be worth now, because they are massive, their artwork. And yeah, like you say, it was just perfect because they obviously had a series of different ones varying on that theme. And, you know, we did all the EPs with them, all the singles, and then the album. And it's interesting, really, because we shouldn't have stopped working with them. Do you know what I mean? I think that's something that we fit, and that's why we went back to working with them on the third album. But, you know, I don't think that's quite the same as working on them for all the records, which in retrospect we really should have done. But I mean, on that second album, there were lots of different pressures from lots of different people. And, you know, that tends to be what happens with something like what we were, when it builds up a lot of steam, a lot of momentum, a lot of different people get involved and they've all got designs on what should be happening, unfortunately. Do you know what I mean? So the second album very much was sort of run by the American side of things, because we had two separate deals. So we had a deal in America as well. So it was like the second album was almost like their turn, really. And, you know, they wanted things done in a very different way. Not that we were bothered. We didn't care, really, for the most part, you know, but they were pushing for, you know, let's go with different artwork, blah, 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 and other things. And, you know, lots of decisions got made in those moments that probably weren't really right for us, but, you know, that's hindsight, isn't it? But certainly, like you say, especially for that first record, you know, that circle's iconic, man. Do you know what I mean? That's why I've got it as my podcast logo now.
Yeah,
man.
I spotted that.
Yeah, it's so recognisable. It's one of those ones that if you ask me to replicate it, I'd really struggle to remember, like, the order of the colours or whatever. Oh, but as soon as you see it, it's like, that's the music. And it's just, so recognisable.
Proper retina burner as well, do you know what I mean? When you've got it on a big screen, you're like, oh, yeah, I recognise that logo. You know, it's unmistakable. I do like that.
I love it. Let's talk about touring around that time then, Adam. You know, just as the album was coming out or shortly after, you must have been getting, you know, a hell of a reception up and down the country, great energy on stage, you know, live shows, you know, Rob thrashing his hair around and all that sort of thing. Yeah. What are your memories of those early gigs?
Oh, man, too many. Do you know what I mean? They were just brilliant, you know, because they were in some horrible, horrible rooms. Do you know what I mean? Some tiny, stinking places, but they're often where you have best nights, man. You know, like Hull Adelphi. I don't know if either of you have ever been to Hull Adelphi. But my God, I mean, after this, look at pictures on Google. It is just someone's living. I mean, look at it from the outside. Honestly, you put Hull Adelphi into Google and it'll come up and it just looks like a fish and chip shop or something like that. Or just like someone's front room. But that, you know, those gigs where, like, as mum and dad came and all his family came and, you know, people going nuts and, you know, they didn't get it. And we were like, wow, this people wanting his autographs and stuff. And those first three tours, we did the North and Midlands and the South with a couple of little breaks in between each leg of it. It's just brilliant memories from them, you know, all kinds of different memories. You know, we used to love in especially the smaller venues. You know, our van would just be parked out front. So come doors opening time, there'd be a, you know, a massive queue of people. And we'd be like, God, look at all these people. You know, you don't understand. We were kids. You know what I mean? We were like 18-year-old kids. Literally just like, oh, God, look at all these people. This is mental. And obviously, we'd then go, all right, well, let's put the Prodigy on full blast and then see if we can rock the van over. So obviously we're in this blacked out van with that on full blast, like everyone's shaking it side to side. Everyone's in queues just looking at this van, just going, what the hell's going on in there? But yeah, too many memories, man. Just years and years. And, you know, we toured that first record for about 3 years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Good, mate. So obviously the debut came out in 2002, didn't it? You know, just as like Strokes, Libertines taking off. You know, great music for guitar, great moment for guitar-driven music, isn't it? Yeah. So who were you playing with at the time on those sort of tours?
So on the big tours and stuff, not really in any order, but we toured with people like Jane's Addiction, Foo Fighters, Queens of the Stone Age, New Order, a couple of gigs with New Order, Oasis, U2, Incubus, Coldplay.
Stellar names, aren't they?
Yeah, we. I mean, you know, Charlatans. Our first support tour was Charlatans. You know what I mean? That was literally. Well, yeah, our first support slot actually was at the Cockpit in Leeds, and it was actually supporting Stephen Malkmus, you know, from Pavement.
Yeah.
I've no idea. I mean, that was I think that might have been literally, other than our tiny little shows, that might have been our first, let's just do something a little bit different, because we built up enough of a fan base that, you know, that everyone who liked us came to that gig, and then it sort of spread from there. Do you know what I mean? But Stephen Malmes, yeah, and then the Charlatans. I think the real big ones that stick in your mind anyway is certainly the U2 gigs, Oasis. And then the big, you know, the big American ones as well. You know, like the Incubus tour, man, that were mad. I mean, they're a brilliant set of lads and amazing musicians as well. Absolutely unbelievable. But like you say, we played with, we played with a lot of great bands.
And what's that like as 18, 19, 20-year-olds, you know, hanging out with these established stars?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it's just not, it just appears to be normal. You know, like our first big day out in Australia with 2003, and you know, still talking to Dave Grohl and stuff like that, and and Josh Homme, just all that stuff just became normal. You know, Josh Homme and PJ Harvey stood having a beer or something like that, and you know, like in fact, there were a party that night at Josh Homme's I don't know, like he's somewhere that he'd rented. I remember that party, actually. Yeah, but I mean, that's what I mean. Just tons of that sort of stuff, tons of those sort of memories. Absolutely, you know, far too many to actually spill out in one moment, certainly.
Love it.
And so let's talk a little bit about the second album then, Adam. So Welcome to the North followed up in 2004. So yeah, you toured that first record for a little while. And you said how the process was a bit different to the first in terms of the sort of American-led influence. So talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of, that certainly played its own role. But I think predominantly the main difference was the fact that, you know, the old cliche of you've got your entire life to, well, your entire youth to write your first album. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, you don't go until it's ready because there's, you know, there's not before it. So you've not like there's anything to, but you know, we toured that record for 3 years, and it was the right thing to do because if you, you know, if you get a bit of success with something like that, you go when people want you. Do you know what I mean? You go, you know, if people want you, you go play. So after 3 years, they suddenly went, right, well, you know, we want an album and we want it in 3 months or something like that. And we'd have like, you know, we wrote that first album over two, three years, really. So that was the first difference, really. We were under pressure And then I think, did we do like 8 or 10 weeks writing? That's all we had. Or did we even have less? And then they effectively turned, and we'd been in America at this point for about 3 months touring on and off, but only back home for a week or so. We'd been there for about 3 months. And we'd just been back a week and the management turned around and said, you're going to America to record this album. And I think I remember going, no, we're not. And they went, yeah, you are. And we're like, oh, brilliant. Just been there for 3 months. Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, the start of that record wasn't easy. They weren't, you know, we were burnt out anyway. We were burnt out from 3 years on road. And then they were like, right, write a song, write an album in 10 weeks. We'd forgotten how to write, for God's sake. Do you know what I mean? It's not like we've been writing in sound checks and stuff like that. It's not how we work. So it was, you know, it was quite stressful. But yeah, and it's nothing against America or Americans in any way, shape or form. Do you know what I mean? I just love being at home. I love being at home. I don't really like traveling and stuff like that. So as you can imagine, for me, touring was a bit of a nightmare, especially later on. I didn't mind it when it were a blast and that, but when it got harder, it was just like, can't be bothered, to be honest. So yeah, we were out there recording that for 10 weeks, what I think it took to make that record. Anyway, it was a good experience. It, you know, it was amazing. I loved it, and it's a great record. But it was made when we were all in very strange headspaces. You know, it messed us up, that. All, you know, sort of the how big we got, how young, proper messed us up. And then, they were just like, right, go make another album. You're just like, I don't even know who I am anymore. Do you know what I mean? Let alone make a record. And then it's a case of, right, go tour that now. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone outside of being in a band thinks that, oh, being in a band is the most amazing experience you're ever going to have. And, you know, it certainly can be, don't get me wrong, but, it's not always like that. Not at all. It's one of the most stressful things I ever did. As I say, it's when the ball's rolling and everything's great, you know, there's nothing, don't get me wrong, there is nothing better. But, when it becomes... Well, you sort of become a victim of your own success to a degree, don't you? Do you know what I mean? That must happen to so many people in so many different walks of life, but you effectively become a victim of your own success. And, you know, like I say, people want deadlines meeting and want things to happen. And so, yeah. It was just a much more rushed process making that record. But we're all really proud of the record that we got out of it. And, I think it reflected where we were all at the time. You know, there's a lot of anger on that album. And it is a slightly different album, but it's still us at heart. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Well, we'll take a quick break there because it was interesting, though. We'll tap into a bit more of that pressure you guys were maybe feeling after the break. And we'll talk about the third album and what came next.
Another pointless video call where nothing gets done. I think you're on mute, David.
Sorry. What did I miss?
IT just approved Miro for the whole company.
Miro? That's the...
online whiteboard. For team collaboration. We can make these long video meetings so much shorter with Miro boards. We can share ideas, feedback, and updates on them whenever. Actually see what we're talking about.
It's all online.
Miro will make our flexible work setup so much easier, with one virtual space for our brainstorms, projects, presentations.
Oh, that sounds kind of amazing. So I don't need to wake up for 6 a.m. calls with the London office anymore.
Now you're getting it.
Don't let time zones get in the way of your team working well together. See why 99% of the Fortune 100 trust Miro to get good work done from anywhere. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hi, I'm Adam from The Music, and you're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this.
Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we're joined by Adam, guitarist in The Music. Now, Adam, we've been chatting about the success of those first two albums. In between albums 2 and 3, there was a bit of a break, wasn't there? You signed to Polydor as well. Maybe tell us a bit about that. But also, you were talking just at the end of the last part about the strain and the stresses perhaps of being within the band. So what was it like being in the music at that time?
Well, obviously being in the music was absolutely amazing when it was sort of going really well. And then it sort of became more difficult, you know what I mean? The whole Polydor thing, I don't know, it's difficult to know what to say about that, really. Hut as we were on it disbanded, so, and the people who came in, I guess, effectively didn't like us. I don't really know. I'm not even sure I can remember. We probably got dropped. Do you know what I mean? You get as a band, you get dropped by record labels. So, So we ended up on Polydor or some wing of Polydor anyway. Do you know what I mean? Mm. That's another story in itself. But yeah, I suppose like in terms of the pressures of being in the band, I mean, I don't know. As I was saying earlier, really, you become a victim of your own success, and you know, it's one thing just having a laugh with your mates, making music, but then when, a lot of people have got invested interest in the success of your music, I guess the pressures increase. Do you know what I mean? And you have to remember as well, the world changed a lot in the between our first and third albums. You know, the sort of rise of the internet and the rise of people stealing music, effectively, shall we say. Do you know what I mean? That finished off guitar music, really. And I don't, you know, there's probably a lot of people who sort of listen to this who steal music now, and they probably don't even feel guilty, really. I have to say, I don't know enough about tech to know how to steal anyone else's music. I don't really know how to buy it. But yeah, there was a massive rise in people just thinking it's all right to have people's product for free, wasn't it? So bands like us, a lot of guitar bands went by the wayside because there just wasn't enough money anymore. And a lot of that came from how people began to consume music, really. So yeah, the third album, making the third album and stuff, it was certainly different for us, but we were living in a different world at that point, I would say. Yeah,
that was a strength in numbers. So that came out in 2008, charted top 20 again. Very passionate fan base that you guys had and desperate to hear it. But how do you think the band had sort of evolved by that point, if you like, musically, but also personally, I guess?
Musically, I don't know, really. I think we worked a certain way for a long time, and then it kind of stopped working, really. We couldn't really find the same level of inspiration, so we changed up, basically. We changed up how we were writing to make that record. And I don't know, we just went about it in a different way, using a bit more technology. I mean, did a lot of that third album in my bedroom, effectively. I had Pro Tools like I've got here. I had that set up, and that's where a lot of that third album came from. You know, we built it up like layer by layer, effectively, yeah.
And in terms of, I know there was a plans for a fourth album after that, but, you know, at what point did you guys sort of feel like the band was maybe sort of starting to run its course a little bit?
It's hard to pinpoint exactly when that happened, but I think when it just became, really hard, you know what I mean? Effectively, it was a case of there's no point doing it anymore. I think that's what it felt like. And that was kind of, we were just, it was just burnt out. It is as simple. It is as simple as that, really. You know, we all developed our own mental health struggles, literally all four of us, you know what I mean? All four sort of at an equal level, really. We all had our own issues, you know. As I say, every one of us had our own issues, and that played its role. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because, you know, in terms of how things are publicized, and it was interesting because you said about sort of Rob's issues. I found that interesting because I think that maybe is how it's perceived, that sort of, oh no, it was Rob's issues that resulted in this. We all had issues, mate. Do you know what I mean? We were, there's none of it. Like I say, it's I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, it, you know, it's talking really openly about this stuff, you know, it's not great. You know what I mean? I don't know how, what this podcast like, whether you get people on who just come on and vibe about how ace it is and is like, oh, I'd love to be in a band. Don't work like that, mate. Don't work like that for me anyway. You know, I never wanted to be, I didn't start making music to be in a band. And I didn't start a band to make music for people. Started a band to make music for myself. It's all I ever gave a damn about, which is why I found it weird when, I don't know, I just never understood that fan aspect of, you know, some sort of ownership over you, do you know what I mean? It's like, no, I created this music for me, you know what I mean, for us. It's a byproduct that everyone else enjoyed it, but, you know, if we get to a point where we're like, yeah, don't want to do that anymore, then you don't do it anymore, you know what I mean? But it's we were very, very young, and we did a hell of a lot, and we were protected very well, but, you know, it's very difficult to protect 4 18-year-old lads come fresh out of school from, you know, the stresses and strains of being in that industry and touring, you know what I mean? And as I say, we were a victim of the way music began to be consumed, because record companies lost all, they lost the ability to let a band develop. Do you know what I mean? Like the Verve, you know, like the Verve's first 2 records, for example, you know, there's no to say in this day and age that after their first record didn't sell that many, they'd have been dropped. Do you know what I mean? There is no longevity in artists anymore. You know, it used to be people like David Boyd at Hut, you know, he'd have all kinds of bands on that roster, and it's not as if you had to sell a bazillion copies or you're gone. And that, unfortunately, is what the music industry turned into. It was very much, like I say, right, you got to sell tons of copies or you're out of there. So that brought with it a lot of pressure, and especially when it was so easy for us to do it when we were younger, and then when we got older, it just kind of didn't work the same. I don't know. There's so many elements to sort of that discussion, but ultimately, yeah, all 4 of us had our own individual issues that we needed to deal with, and it wasn't a particularly healthy place at some point, do you know what I mean, being in the band. And I would wager as well, any people you speak to who say it's all just rosy, I mean, funny, but they're lying, you know what I mean? Quite simple as that, the lying.
Yeah. I think we've spoken to so many. I think you're singing from the same hymn sheet as a lot of other people. You know, there's untold amounts of amazing experiences, but yeah, there's that other side of it that's the fans don't know about. It can be tough, can't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. And the fans, all the fans see is that, or anyone sees, not so much the fans. I mean, it sounds like I've got a problem with the fans. I haven't at all. Love the fans, obviously. But it's very easy for them to see things very simply. Do you know what I mean? Through sort of rose-tinted glasses, and just, you know, everyone does it, don't they? You know, someone says, oh, this is happening and I can't do that. And you're like, well, just do that. That's the obvious thing to do. You know, a lot of people are like, well, why didn't you release the 4th album? Why aren't you still together? You know, life don't work like that, man. And not everyone don't always have a right to know these things either, if you know what I mean. But yeah, it was always difficult managing people, and it depends when you speak to people as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've been good over it years, me, when people have, because I'm bipolar as well. Do you know? And I've got ADHD, so sometimes you talk to me, you know, it's not going to go well at all, regardless of how lovely you are. But yeah, over the years, I did really well at not taking anyone by surprise, shall we say. But yeah, there's times where you're really not in a good headspace, and people are coming up to you and they're just like, all, you know what I mean, like fired up and asking you all this stuff and how great it all is and stuff, and you're just like, oh God, you know what I mean, if you only knew the truth. But so I don't know, it's the same, and I like to think a bit like sort of footballers as well, especially now, do you know what I mean, how young footballers are taking on, you know, stupid ages, 7, 8, and all the way till 15, 16, and then suddenly they're told they're not good enough, when, you know, all the way from, you know, being really aware of what life's about, they've been thinking, I'm going to be a footballer. You know what I mean? And then they get to 16 and they're like, no, you're not. And then it's like, all right, what am I going to do? You know, that was certainly a big deal for me after the band. And I've talked about it at great length on my YouTube channel and on my own podcast, really. I've done loads of 40-minute video history videos, I call them, but it's me just talking about life after the band, really. And the sort of problems that I faced in the transition from being in a band of that level to, you know, going, so well, you know, to attempting to live a normal life, which is what I've been attempting to do for 10 years now. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, a lot of that is documented on my YouTube channel in some rather emotional videos, some of them. But, you know, I mean, that was all born as a result of people asking questions. So I thought, well, I'll just make some YouTube videos. You know what I mean? It seems a quick way to say stuff.
Yeah, definitely. It's tricky to come up with an answer, though, isn't it? Because, as you say, you know, when you're 17, 18, you want it all, don't you? I guess you lap up this this lifestyle. But, you know, how do you, who is there to protect you, really? Because, you know, the record companies aren't there to, you know, give you mental health advice or anything like that, or to protect you from certain things, or to tell you to go slow, because, as you say, they need to shift the records and make the money. And, you know, obviously that's been exacerbated by the, you know, the switch to online streaming and things like that. Mm. And yeah, as you said about, you know, bands having time to, you know, develop, but who's, you know, who's going to be funding you? You know, you talked about players in a football academy. At least when you're between 6 and 16, you're within the academy and you're protected in there, and you get a bit of education. Maybe you get a bit of, you know, just life and social skills thrown in on top of the football training. But as a band, you turn up at 18 and it's like, right, what are you going to do? Start selling these records for us, start going gigging for us. There's no sort of slow, steady process building into it, is there?
No. Like you say, it's, and our management were brilliant in that, because they recognise how young we were, and they did the best to, they can't hold his hand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they did their best to make it as easy as it could be, but I mean, you know, like we're saying, the highs are extremely high and brilliant, but the lows are equally as low, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, everyone knows, don't they? Like when you're really like I don't know, hot property, shall we say? Everyone wants to know you, and everyone's around, and stuff's happening, and people are ringing you, and you're having to meet people, and there's teams of people doing stuff. But then when you're not, all that goes in the click of fingers. All that goes. Do you know what I mean? And that's an incredibly tough transition, because, like you say, and it'll be the same for those footballers who don't make it, that have had all that right up until they're told, right, you're out because you're not good enough. And then suddenly they're not funded for the counselling and stuff that they might need. Suddenly it's, you know, it's down to the parents or themselves, and, you know, to look at themselves and go, right, I've got to pick myself up now. You know, I think there's quite a movement, actually, isn't there, for, especially in football, to deal with that problem, if you will. Do you know what I mean? That problem of these kids being an afterthought, because it's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, it's like, right, we're prepared to give you everything while we think we can make something from you, but the second we don't, you're off. And, you know, there should be at least some sort of plan, though. They should give you people to look after you, even just for like 8 months, do you know what I mean? Until you build some life skills, for God's sake. Because that's the most difficult thing. If you're born into something like this, which we were effectively at 15, 16, come on, you're effectively born into it, because all you've ever known is school. To come out of it and then look at doing something else, just, you know, especially when you love what you do more than anything. I'm talking about making music here, not necessarily touring it around the world and all that stuff, which does have its ups, but it has its downs. But, you know, when all I wanted to do was make music, and suddenly it was like, well, what, you know, and I did have when the music split up, I did write a lot of songs, and I had the intentions of doing it again, effectively, you know, starting another band. And I just, for varying reasons, but I just woke up one day and I was just like, I just can't be bothered doing this anymore, to be honest. So I stopped doing it. I didn't even play guitar for 10 years, literally, until I've got my guitars out of storage when that listening party, when that listening party was announced. That's when I got my guitars out of storage. So, yeah.
So is the music that you're writing now, is that for the music, or is this for something else?
No, it's just for me, mate. Yeah, it's literally for me. I mean, like I said, I the way I down tools 10 years ago for various reasons, but there's been a lot building up inside me, I guess. I didn't think I'd ever do this again. I got the confidence back from being on Twitter and you know, I didn't know anyone remembered us, let alone me or my guitar playing had influenced anyone. So to have all this sort of feedback from fans on Twitter, because I've never been on social media before. Do you know what I mean? I've been a gardener in woods and stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, messing about on social media means no to me. But you know, it's I've loved connecting with all these people, and that's given me the confidence to effectively start writing again. So yeah, I've been writing since early September, and I've got about 20 songs now. So, you know, well, I've got more than an album's worth, definitely, but I want 30 or 40 really before I think about recording all of them belters as well, you know. That's it, man. I'm not interested in no numbers, man. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, that'll make up a number. No, I'm not. There's no rush. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to make it myself. It's all going to be sort of self-funded, so to speak. You know, it's all on my terms. I don't know how it's going to manifest in the long run, but it's not really important for me. The important thing for me is actually making the tunes, writing the songs, getting, you know, the emotions out. And it's a therapeutic thing, is writing songs, writing music. And, you know, I'm really enjoying singing as well. It's not something I've ever really done, but I've discovered that I really enjoy singing. So yeah, I'm building up a lot of material, and I'm really, really excited about the future and putting a sort of a band together. I mean, I've already got people in mind, but yeah, putting a band together, and whether I end up touring it, I don't know, but certainly, you know, I'm gonna make records. That's what I'm gonna do from now on. Yeah, but in, you know, in terms of the music or whatever, that's not what we're thinking about at all. This is just like, you know, this reunion show. That's what it is, really. It is a reunion show, sort of celebrating it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, you never say never in life, but it's not like we're reforming as such. It's a reunion, it's a celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit like your podcast as well, because if anyone hasn't heard that, yeah, you go and check it out. It's some good stories from behind the scenes, from and reflections really on all different aspects of the band, isn't it? From tour buses to how songs are written and things like that. So it's almost what we've done today, but a lot more in depth, isn't it, each episode? So it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, man, I'm really enjoying that. And that was as a result of, again, the feedback from the listening party, me ending up making YouTube videos to effectively block answer people's questions in one go. And as a result of that, a couple of people said, you should really make a podcast. I didn't even know what a podcast was. Looked into it and thought, why not? You know, I talked about it on one of my YouTube videos. As a result, a bloke who knows about podcasts got in touch with me and said, I'll help you. So that's where it sort of started. But like you say, it's just a, it's an opportunity to reflect on stuff, you know, because I didn't know that anyone wanted to hear sort of the things I've got to say. I had no idea. I'd never be as sort of, well, not that I'm saying, well, I don't know. Yeah, I think you're a narcissistic idiot if you sit there and you think, well, everyone's going to want to listen to me. Do you know what I mean? I'm important. You know, that's so not me. Do you know what I mean? You've got to work really hard to make me come out of my shell. And I think that's what the months leading up to the listening party, and then the months after that, leading up to the announcement of the gig, and you know, I was so heavily active on Twitter and stuff like that. It's sort of exciting times again, really. It certainly is.
Yeah, well, everyone definitely should go and listen to that podcast. I highly recommend it. We're gonna wrap things up now, Adam, with the encore. So sticking with podcasts, obviously you mentioned you were quite new to the podcast world before, but now you're sort of immersed in it. Are there any podcasts that you would like to recommend? Any others that you listen to?
I don't know. I mean, I'm probably not the person to ask. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't know. I don't really listen to many. Honestly, I'm in here all the time on you know, making tunes, putting beats together, putting bass lines on them, building track up, singing over it, or I'm just singing on a guitar. So I can't really recommend any podcast apart from mine and yours. Know about that? I recommend yours. I recommend mine as well. Yeah,
yeah, I like that. Perfect. Two good recommendations. Yeah.
Yesterday's Jam. Gareth at Yesterday's Jam is a really nice fella, and I really enjoyed doing that one as well. So that would be another one.
Awesome. Cool. Best gig when you're in the music first time around. So can you any standout shows from that time?
Yeah, lots. A venue in Paris called La Cigale. That was absolutely amazing. Grand Old Opry.
We didn't really touch on that, Adam. How did the music go down sort of in, outside of the UK?
Oh, man, I mean, better. You know, like, honestly, like Japan, my God, you know what I mean? They're absolutely, we were the perfect mix of energy, tunes, sort of Englishness, I guess, because, you know, they love English music over there. And yeah, we blew up in Japan, man. Do you know what I mean? We must have been there 15 times. Do you know what I mean? Like, all kinds of shows. But yeah, it's sort of, and a lot of Europe as well. Do you know what I mean? We did quite well over in Europe and Australia and places like that. Everywhere reacted mega to us. Do you know what I mean? And that's something I always say. Gaining new fans, playing to new people were always the best thing, because you can see them stood there going, well, all right, win me over. And you inevitably do win them over. But yeah, it's sort of, in terms of best gigs, I mean, every time we played Brixton, we're amazing. Last Dance were good, actually, in Leeds.
That was the farewell show, right?
That was, yeah. That was a good one. I think we did three nights, though, didn't we? So they were all good. But yeah, I think whenever anyone says the best gig, I always think to La Cigale in Paris. It would just, I think the stage were fully wooden as well. It was like a proper theatre, and it just sounded amazing. Because that's how I judge my favourite gigs, really, is when it's the right sort of room, and I can hear everything in the way I want, and then you relax, then you really enjoy it, and you know, you actually feel like you're playing. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can't even, you can hear yourself just enough to get by, but you can't hear yourself enough to enjoy it. You know what I mean? And it's nothing to do with volume, all kinds of different things, rolling frequencies, depending on what room you're in, room reflections, you know what I mean? How many people are in the room, the temperature, all kinds of things. And, you know, being sort of the character I am, stuff like that to drive me mad, you know what I mean? So sometimes you get on the stage and you play it first notes and you're like, oh no, this is going to be a nightmare. I could never be bothered with that. Well, who would, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. Like asking someone to act if they can't see the other person. Do you know what I mean? It's always going to be like really difficult. You'd be able to effectively come up with something, but it's never going to be as good as when you can hear everything mint and, you know, you can just play. So yeah. Or like the first time we played Leeds Festival as well, that were insane in that tent. A lot of shows, man. It's difficult to really.
Tough question, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the different ones from different countries, different years, but yeah, man, a lot of good ones. Yeah.
Lots of good shows, lots of good tunes as well. Last question, Adam, is can you pick out one of those tunes, the song that you're proudest of?
Well, I suppose it'd have to be Long Road, really, in terms of sort of how, well, I guess the effect it had on music at that time, I would say. You know, again, that's something I wouldn't have had the confidence to say, but since all this has kicked off in my sport to lots of people, it's quite evident that that had an impact on people. Do you know what I mean? And when, after very early on Twitter, I put a little riff feed out playing Long Road. It got like 30,000 views after a few hours. And I'm like, bloody hell, people must like that song. So in terms of actual pride, I think, yeah, you know, stuff like Long Road, The People and Get Away, do you know what I mean? I think those, and Truth, those singles off that first record. But, you know, stuff like, I think my favourite of all our songs is Open Your Mind off Welcome to the North. I think, you know, in terms of a song anyway. But again, you know, it depends what mood I'm in or what sort of tune, do you know what I mean? Because on another day, I'd say Welcome to the North is one of my favourites. Got too many, really, do you know what I mean? Like, they're all close to my heart for various reasons.
Yeah, it's nice that after 10 years or so, you'll be able to start playing them again. And for those comeback shows, that's going to be really good fun. Adam, thanks for coming onto the show. So it's been great sort of reminiscing about the music story, talking about the industry more broadly and what you're up to now as well. And the new music coming up.
Yeah, man, thank you for having me. I hope I didn't get too morose in pass, although I don't you know, it's not everything's, you know, all sunshine and roses, is it, though? But yes, thank you very much for having me on. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, really looking forward to Temple Newsham and that, and hope to see as many people there as possible.
Cool, nice one.
Hi, I'm Allie Raisman. I've been living with migraine for a while. As an athlete and gymnast, I was taught to just power through the pain. Now I use Ubrelvy or Ubrogepant to treat my migraine attacks. As soon as I feel a migraine attack, I take Ubrelvy, which provides me with quick relief. Once I get relief, I go on with my day. I'm partnering with Ubrelvy to share my migraine story.
Ubrelvy quickly stops migraine in its tracks within 2 hours without worrying where you are. Most people had quick pain relief within 2 hours. Ubrelvy treats migraine attacks in adults and is not for prevention. It's available by prescription only. Do not take Ubrelvy with strong CYP3A4 inhibitors. Tell your healthcare provider about all the medicines you take. Most common side effects are nausea and tiredness.
My hope is that by sharing my migraine story and the relief I get from Ubrelvy, it can help someone else.
Ask your doctor about Ubrelvy, the anytime, anywhere migraine medicine. Learn more at Ubrelvy.com or call 844-4-U-B-R-E-L-V-Y. Sponsored by AbbVie.